Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dad's gum government, you saw it so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dad's gum, dad's gum, dad's gum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Well, your dad's gum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes? Uh-huh.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman and Tenacity. This is Terry Dodd, your host for this evening, and my co-host here, Mike Gaddy. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing great, Terry. I hope you are as well.
I am. I'm a little tired, been running mighty hard, and just trying to avoid as many leftist crazies who are paranoid out of their minds that believe everybody needs to be wearing this thing over your face that makes you sweat and blocks your oxygen. what a week. Tonight's going to be a very special
one thing
night.
For
we're
sure.
Yeah?
I'm just going to say one thing for sure. We don't need IQ tests anymore.
Well, I'm afraid I agree with you, but I wouldn't want people to get the idea that I was proud of my myself there. Wow. Let's start this show right with a prayer, Mike. I'm going to open us
with a
prayer.
Go ahead, sir. You go ahead, sir.
Father in heaven, you definitely have a sense of humor. And your prophecies are amazingly accurate, and we just are thankful for the way that you have taught us. You've given us an opportunity to learn and to grow and to make the right decisions and in some cases make the wrong ones, but we learn from them because of your spirit that you sent in the name of your son. Father, we just we ask you to watch over us during this show tonight. We're going to be talking about some pretty heavy things that went on at the founding of this federation, this supposed republic. And we just pray that you help us bring the truth out and that you open the minds of those that are hearing this message tonight. Take control of Mike and myself, and we surrender to your spirit and invite you to straighten us out, to take the chaff out and separate it from our wheat, and help us to speak only the truth. We're thankful for the way you support us and the way that you're available for us. And thank you for answering our prayers. In the name of your Son, our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Mike,
amen.
You know, we keep talking about history pointing to what's happening with us today. I think tonight is a shining example of that, because I mean, how much insider trading is there? How many of these congressmen and senators walk into office nearly broke compared to what they walk out with, and certainly they're not getting rich from their salary, not the kind of wealth that they're acquiring. And I just look forward to your lesson tonight to show us that this started over 200 years ago, and it's basically not stopped since. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you, Mike, because give us a good history lesson.
Well, Terry, I would like to start, and thanks for that intro. I would like to start with, especially since we mentioned and you brought up as you did, I remember making myself very unwelcome in town hall meetings when I lived in Colorado especially when I showed up at a town hall meeting and asked our congressman, who is still a member of Congress at that time, when I asked him, raise my hand and ask the question, and he said, he said, well, what's your question, Mike? And I said, well, Scott, here's my question. I said, according to published records, 18 months ago when you took office, your net worth was listed at $2.9 million. And currently today when I checked, your net worth was listed at 11.3. Could you tell us how you managed to make that much money in that short a length of time? Well, I didn't get an answer. No one else got an answer. And from any meetings from that point forward, I was never called on for a question, no matter how many times I raised my hand. But as you said, that's not a new phenomenon, and they have been following the examples of such corruption now for better than 230 years. And we know that during the Revolutionary War, we had one gentleman who was in charge of everything financial for the Revolutionary War. And we have talked about him before. His name was Robert Morris. He was from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And he not only was in charge of all of the financial arrangements during the Revolutionary War, but he also had his own bank, and he also had his own companies that were providing goods to the Revolutionary Army. So here we have a man who was in charge of the finances for the government, and yes, this was under the Articles of Confederation. But here he was given basically carte blanche to do whatever he could do. And, of course, he started off with the first bank in this country's history, which was called the Bank of North America. And he immediately went into fractional reserve banking and loaned money out to his political friends, who then bought interest in the bank, bought shares in the bank. And it was alleged by Sentinel, who was Samuel Bryan, in many of his articles, it was alleged, and he provides some pretty sound evidence, that during that period of time, Mr. Morris was able to accumulate vast amounts of money for himself while he was managing the war effort financially. And so then the Federalists, which Morris was a prominent member of the Federalists, they started screaming for a new government because the government that they had was so broke. And, of course, the bank went under after 5 years in 1785 or 86. It went down the tubes. It was basically broke. They had milked it for all the money they could get out of it. And so then they wanted a new form of government. And basically, Terry, the bottom line here is what wanted was these aristocrats, or the wealthy and well-born, as Alexander Hamilton called them, the people who knew better than everyone else, as Washington said, the people who had a right to lead because of their superior knowledge. They had decided that the Articles of Confederation were too weak because they could not find a way to tax the people to make them pay for everything they wanted paid for. And with Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation, all one state had to do was to say, no, we're not voting for that. And if one state said no, it did away with their tax scheme. So they started working very early on, especially with Hamilton and Richard Morris and Gouverneur Morris and James Madison, started working very early on to try to get a totally new form of government in place that would allow them unlimited taxation. And for those who doubt the fact that that was their number one purpose, the number one article, the number one power that was given to Congress was in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, and that was the form of unlimited taxation from unlimited means. They established their ability to tax right off. Well, then the thing that they wanted to do was to make sure, when they got the first government sitting in place with their first Congress, which was heavily dominated by the Federalists, they wanted to make sure that they could set up a taxing scheme, but the first thing they wanted to do was to assume all of the debts that the country owed from the war and from what have you. Well, basically, by doing that, they were assuming the monies to pay off the monies that Robert and Gouverneur Morris had stolen or have were alleged to have stolen. And, of course, records weren't good back then. It was hard to keep up with it. But we do know that after constant request, Robert Morris would never provide the records to Congress. Now, if you had a good – if you wanted to make people think that, hey, I'm not the crook that Samuel Bryan is calling me, why would you not produce these records? And then at the Constitutional Convention in Article 6, Section 1, they had put in that – the debts against the United States would be assumed, and they didn't mention anything about the debts owed to the United States. And I thought, as a simple bookkeeping measure, Article 6, Section 1, why wouldn't you have said that we want to make all debts, if we're going to do this, let's make all debts, and what is owed to the country as well as what the country owes, to put them both out in a fair ledger. But they didn't do that. The only thing that the Constitution assumed in Article 6, Section 1 was the debts against the United States. And they wanted to get all of these paid. And so being Secretary of Treasury and Hamilton, I want to remind everyone, on June 18, 1787, Hamilton proposed a monarchical form of government, and which he didn't get in word, but I think in many ways he did. But having assumed his position with the Treasury, Hamilton immediately set about to make the Secretary of Treasury the most powerful position in government. And as we have read before, Terry, the letter from Washington to Hamilton about 1794, when he started asking him about all of these financial situations and how all of these things had occurred. And it was quite a list of questions. I think there were 26 that Washington asked him that I do not feel like Hamilton ever answered appropriately. But Hamilton made it the most important office in government. And he wrote several major reports to Congress urging that Congress to adopt a policy of debt, higher taxation, central banking, protectionism, and tax-funded subsidies for businesses. Corporate welfare began under Alexander Hamilton with the very first Congress. Hamilton wrote two separate reports advocating for this debt that he was asking. The first called for the new government to assume all of the old government debt, something that hardly anyone did.
Mike, something just happened to your sound.
New bonds would be issued. I'm sorry, Terry, did you say something?
Something just happened to your sound.
Hello? Terry, can you hear me?
Yes, I do now, but I wasn't able to. You were off in the distance, like you were speaking through one of those megaphones from way off for just a second.
Oh, wow, I'm hearing that now. I'm trying to figure out what in the dickens is going on here.
I'll let you know right away, so you can pick right up wherever you were.
Okay. Are we doing okay now?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Talking about the reports that Hamilton wrote advocating this government debt was the first, as I said, the first call for a new government, for this brand new government to assume all the old government debts, and then new bonds would be issued backed by revenue from new tariffs that Hamilton was instrumental in putting into place. So they assumed these debts, and then Hamilton immediately starts coming up with tax schemes. And he said the old war debt was to be cashed out at full face value. The plan immediately became public knowledge in New York City, where the government was sitting. So the people in New York City knew that the government was about to assume all of these war debts at face value. It said, according to one historian, it says, but the news of this spread slowly via horseback and sailing vessel to the rest of the country. So this in turn created tremendous speculative opportunities for Hamilton and his New York City banking cohorts and his political cohorts, and including, of all people, Robert Morris, who was also involved. And Robert Morris ended up being Hamilton's legislative liaison to the U.S. Senate. And Hamilton's father-in-law, Philip Schuyler, he made a tremendous amount of money in this too. New York speculators, having been given this inside information, embarked on a mad scramble up and down the eastern seaboard to purchase these government bonds. And so they bought them from hapless and unsuspecting war veterans who had these bonds as payment. And so they went to the war veterans and they bought their up their bonds for as little as 2 cents on what we would call 2 cents on the dollar today. And the most they paid was 10% of the full face value. And here is something that I found that I thought was unique, and it was written in Jefferson and Hamilton by Claude Bowers. And it says, and I quote, "Expresses with very large sums of money on their way to North Carolina for purposes of speculation in certificates, splashed and bumped over the wretched winter roads. And two fast sailing vessels chartered by a member of Congress who had been an officer in the war were plowing the waters southward in a similar mission." And ironically, John Quincy Adams would later write to his father, John Adams, and he said, and in this he said, and I quote, "Christopher Gore, the richest lawyer in Massachusetts and one of the strongest Massachusetts members of Hamilton's political machine, had made an independent fortune in speculation in the public funds." So in essence, what we have, Terry, is they ended up running up and down the eastern seaboard, buying up all of these war bonds they could because they knew they were going to be redeemed at face value, but they were running, buying them from veterans and other people who had provided assets to be used in the war. They bought these up at very, very discounted rates, and because they knew that the very people that they were cheating on one end were then going to be required to come up with the tax money to pay their profits at full face value. And reading again from one of the reports, it said war bonds that war veterans had held for years were coaxed from them for 5 and even as low as 2% or 2 shillings on the pound by speculators, including leading members of Congress, who knew that provision for the redemption of the paper at full face value had been made. Everywhere, men with capital were feverishly pushing their advantage by preying on the ignorance of the population. New York newspapers speculated that Robert Morris made $18 million on his speculations on these bonds. And it says, Governor George Clinton, and you and I spoke about this before the show started, Terry, but Governor George Clinton made himself, and he was an anti-federalist. He fought against ratification of the Constitution, but I guess he decided when it comes to money, we better join these folks. And so he pocketed a cool $5 million. And Hamilton also bought some of these bonds. And then when he was confronted with it about a conflict of interest being as Secretary of the Treasury, he claimed that he had purchased these bonds for his brother-in-law. And so to pay off the bondholders, the government needed a steady revenue stream. Thus, it is perhaps not surprising that Hamilton relentlessly campaigned for a mechanism to ensure sufficient revenue and eliminate the risk of investing in government bonds, to wit, higher taxes. Hamilton was as responsible as anyone for the tariffs and the various excise taxes, including the notorious tax on whiskey, which led to a government intervention to collect the tax, a carriage tax, and a national property tax, which actually spawned a tax revolt in the state of Massachusetts which was known as the Fry's Rebellion, and I promise you most people weren't taught about that in school. Plundering the common ordinary working class with onerous taxes would be a valuable spur, according to Hamilton, and this just shows you the extent of the mind of these politicians. It would be a valuable spur forcing them to work harder. This would be good for them as Americans are too indolent anyway, claimed Alexander Hamilton. So,
Mike,
what do you think about that so far, buddy?
I'll tell you what's going through my mind. This is making me realize, it's making me realize a lot. But you probably heard me talk about what the Rothschilds did when Napoleon lost in the stock market in London, and how they tremendously increased their wealth. And I think people need to remember the numbers that you're talking about are worth today at least 25 to 30 times the numbers that you're throwing out. So,
well,
somebody made 20 million, we're talking about, you know, 30 times that, which would be, you know, 600 million, almost $1 billion that we're talking about,
right,
that these guys made at the time.
Well,
but let's look at the timeline real quick. When was the war over?
Officially 1783.
1783. The convention in Philadelphia, they had a failed one in Annapolis in what, 86?
Right.
And then they finally got Washington to show up in 87. And within 3 years of that convention, they have put a situation in where they can collect taxes with this unlimited power. They have managed to rip the people off that had sold goods and had basically, they had taken these notes, these bonds, right, in payment for goods and services during the war that were owed to the people, and the people were sitting there broke and had to give up these bonds and notes and stuff for, like you said, 3 to 5 cents on the dollar, but practically all of them under 20 cents on the dollar for sure. And these guys used an insider knowledge. This had to be planned from the inception of that doggone convention in Philadelphia in 1787, Mike. This is a part of the whole cotton picking thing. They had this strategized out to the T, and that's why they closed the doors and got everybody under a 50-year secrecy thing, was because of the doggone money. You have followed the money, and you have absolutely nailed this, Mike. You've nailed it to exactly why they wanted to get rid of the Articles of Confederation and put this new Constitution into play, because it was a part of them ripping the people off. Right then and the time. Forget about all the future problems and the prophetic predictions of the anti-federalists. These cats were trying to get rich on the spot, and they did.
Point. We talked about it before. I looked at my figures, and there were 73 members of the House of Representatives who voted for this assumption. There were 73 members in the House, and they were, it was, and the House was 5-1 Federalist, and 29 members of Congress had speculated in these bonds. So do you think they're going to vote against their own interest?
You know the answer to that. I don't need to answer it.
Well, you know, it's a rhetorical question, but it, and I don't think as we talk about paralleling the government back then as it started in 1789 with what's happening today with the corruption, you know, and I made the point on a talk show earlier today, it absolutely amazes me that Americans will run out and support billionaires for political office. Because the thing about it is that people don't understand is the people who are ultra wealthy could really care less what kind of government they live under, because almost without fail, they're going to be controlling it. So it makes no difference to them. If they have all of this money, they're going to be able to buy whatever influence they want, and it's always to the detriment of the common man. And so it started, as we've talked about, it started in 1787. They had to get out from under the Articles of Confederation. They were too restrictive. And so that was one of the things that Hamilton did. And then they came up with this second deal. And the second deal was also an assumption. And Congress was up and running. Everything's going good. And so Hamilton now wants to get these, after he had got the federal government to assume the old government debt, he then embarked on a crusade to have the central government assume the war debts of all of the states. So he's going to pull the same scam all over again. The same thing happened again. More and more people got fantastically wealthy. And so he absolutely thought that, hey, this won't be hard to get by Congress because look how many members of Congress have become overwhelmingly wealthy with this maneuver. So during the American Revolution and long thereafter, the colonies or states considered themselves to be free and independent. This is the exact language that was used in the Declaration of Independence. They considered themselves to be independent countries. And if you go through the writing, even up to the Civil War period, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson both referred to Virginia as their country. And many people felt like their states were their countries. And in the 18th century, the word Congress meant an assembly of sovereign countries. The states individually taxed their citizens and borrowed as well to finance the war. When the war ended, King George of England signed a peace treaty with each individual state. Not the state as a whole, but each individual state. So that, and it did not become some consolidated entity called the United States government. Consequently, each state had accumulated an amount of war debt. Some states, like Virginia, were more diligent and responsible than others had been, and they had completely paid off their debt. And so they were totally against this. They did not like this at all, the way it was going. They did not like what was happening because they had paid off their debt. Now they were going to be taxed to pay off the debt for others. And we can understand them being upset about that. You know, I certainly would have been. Why should the people of Virginia, who had paid off their war debt, now, under an assumption, be taxed to pay off the war debts of the other states? But anyway, that's what they wanted. And so what happened then was that Hamilton proposed socializing the debt. And this would have forced the more responsible states to pay taxes to subsidize those who were less responsible. And so to fund the nationalization of the war debt, Hamilton proposed the notorious whiskey tax and other excise taxes. Jefferson and Madison, and Madison had now, I think, figured out that he was going to lose all kind of political clout if he didn't start supporting Jefferson and Jefferson's plan, because Jefferson had figured this whole thing out. And so, amazingly, in the Pennsylvania legislature, a gentleman by the name of Albert Gallatin decided that he would oppose this assumption of war debts. And he said the assumption plan, and I quote, is subversive of the rights, liberty, and peace of the people. And his remarks were endorsed by the entire Pennsylvania legislature. So Gallatin also recognized that government debt actually drained productive investment capital from the private sector, and it did not increase the existing amount of cultivated lands, of houses, of consumable commodities, and that's a quote, and did not make the smallest addition either to the wealth or to the annual labor of a nation. And those were all direct quotes from his presentation to the Philadelphia legislature. Now, most folks have never heard of Albert Gallatin. You and I talked on another show about them one time, Terry, about him. And he became the longest sitting Secretary of Treasury in history. And he started under Thomas Jefferson and ended under James Monroe, I believe. So, and he made such dramatic changes in the mess that Hamilton had left, which makes for a great study. But anyway, this goes through. Hamilton tried to push this through Congress and kept calling in all of his friends to push this through Congress, and they brought it up five times, Terry, and all five times it was voted down. And they said, no, we're not going to do this. And Hamilton was most distressed because he had promised his fellow gang members, if I may, the fact that they were going to make another bunch of money on this assumption. And so, but he became quite distressed, and he figured out that the only way he was going to be able to make this work was to get Madison and Jefferson to go along with him, so he had to have something to trade. And so what he did was they met for dinner in Jefferson's apartment in New York, and Hamilton tells them that, look, here's what I'll do. If you guys will convert the swing votes I need in Virginia to get this assumption tax through, I will get my people in Congress to vote to have the capital of the United States in the swamps in Virginia, which is now where it is in Washington, D.C. So Jefferson later wrote in his, just a few years before he passed away in 1826, I think it was 1823, he wrote that agreeing to this assumption was probably one of the greatest mistakes he had made in his lifetime. And he agreed to do this. And so critics of Hamilton's financial plan here were outraged that a tax burden was being placed on poor farmers in order to assure that the interest payments were paid to the wealthy. Still others feared that the new taxes would let loose a swarm of harpies who, under the domination of revenue officers, will range throughout the country prying into every man's house and affairs. Can anyone say the Internal Revenue Service? They feared, in other words, a new army of tax-collecting bureaucrats, just like the ones with whom King George III had plagued America just a few years before. So any thoughts at this point, Terry?
Yeah, they make these thieves, these liars and thieves, into heroes so that people will forget about it, so they can pull the same crap again and again and again. This is the number one example of how history will repeat itself, because people don't know their history.
Well, I think, you're exactly right. Your point on, and that is, and I agree that it's not only they don't know their history, but they don't know their correct history. Most of the history that you can get people to repeat today is that came through the Marxist indoctrination, politically correct indoctrination that our young people, or all the people, have been getting in mandated government education for the past 100 years.
So what we're seeing is the fruit on the vine now of all of that massive Marxist education. We've got a group of people all over the country acting like Marxists. Imagine that. But Senator John Taylor, he was called John Taylor of Caroline, from Virginia, he pointed out that consolidating taxing and borrowing powers in the central government would lead to a suppression of the Republican state assemblies by depriving them of political importance resulting from the imposition and dispensation of taxes. There were some smart people back then. This, said Taylor, would destroy the system of federalism that the Constitution allegedly created, replacing it with a court-style English government that would result in the accumulation of great wealth in a very few hands. What do we have in this country today, and what is this coronavirus designed to do but to further eliminate the middle class and to create a complete socialist Marxist society?
Amen.
So let's look at what we had with the wonderful Mr. Hamilton while he was in office. And with his Federalist Party in power, Congress spending skyrocketed, as did taxation and government borrowing. Indeed, Hamilton and his fellow Federalists accumulated much more government debt than was necessary for any government expenditure programs. Imagine that, too much debt. After all, Hamilton's objective was, first and foremost, concentrating economic and political power in the federal government. And so there was a let me see, I'm trying to look at my notes here. Okay, John C. Miller, who wrote in his History of the Federalist Era, he said this would effectively abolish federalism and states' rights, which has been accomplished. Miller chronicled the results of the assumption legislation, and I would like to read that, and I quote, "The national debt soared to a total of over $80 million. To service this debt, almost 80% of the annual expenditures of the government were required." So 80% of the money spent by the government was to service, just pay the interest on the debt. And this, we're talking, guys, we hadn't even got to 1800 yet. During this period, from 1790 to 1800, payment of the interest alone of the national debt consumed 40% of the national revenue. For a nation whose government had been tottering on the brink of bankruptcy under the Articles of Confederation, according to the Federalists, this might well be regarded as a staggering burden of debt. So the debt that was complained about by the Federalists, as soon as they got in office, they tripled and quadrupled that debt. So it wasn't an emergency circumstance, that's for sure. Also, I think this is critical. They had gotten to the point that Hamilton and the Federalists decided that they had to use their power to make it illegal to criticize the government, because people were beginning to catch on to what the Federalists had done. And so here we have, okay, now we've got to come up with this Alien and Sedition Act. We've got to shut people up. With the Federalist John Adams as president, Congress passed the Notorious Sedition Act, which was written so that it would expire the day Adams left office. Is that unique or what? Journalists, ordinary citizens, and even a member of Congress, Matthew Lyon of Vermont, were actually imprisoned for criticizing the government. A Revolutionary War veteran named Anthony Haswell. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Compare this to the ratification dates and time, and how many states at this point had ratified.
Well, at this point, all of them were in, Terry, because in 1789, the government took place. In 1791, the Bill of Rights was completed. Shortly after the Bill of Rights was completed, Rhode Island and New York and North Carolina ratified the Constitution and came in. So you have all 13 states in by this time.
By 1790?
1791.
Well, yeah, but didn't Hamilton start this process in 1790?
Oh, yes. He definitely did. Well, as soon as the government took effect in under the new constitution, took effect in March of 1789. So in a very short period of time, he started working, putting these all these things together. And of course, he was the first Secretary of Treasury, so he started the stuff.
That's my point. He wasted absolutely no time. He had to have this laid out all the way back in 1786.
Well, I think if you look at the time he started petitioning the New York legislature to have a new convention and a new constitution within months of the Articles of Confederation being ratified. This had been Hamilton's scheme, I believe, possibly seven years before the Constitutional Convention. So there is no doubt Samuel Bryan referred to the Constitutional Convention and everything leading up to it as a criminal conspiracy. And if you will remember, last week we talked about the ratification convention in Virginia when Edmund Pendleton, under interrogation by Patrick Henry, had said it is not material whether we violated the law or not. It makes no difference as to ratification. So if we violated the rules, so what? That has no relevancy here. And I remember us talking about that last week. So if people cannot see that this was a mass conspiracy, as you said, and I believe, that started back probably before the war was even over, that they had planned to use their influence and their power to convert the government into one of their use. So as I was talking about earlier, I was going into the Sedition Act. And so after 10 years of this and the country is in huge debt again, much worse than it was when the Constitution first started. So then we have that problem. Then they come up. So the Federalists said, well, we've got to shut this. People are revealing what we're doing. It's being talked about. Everything is coming out. We've got to do something about this. So they come up with the Sedition Act. And as I said, journalists, ordinary citizens, and even a member of Congress, Matthew Lyon of Vermont, were imprisoned for merely criticizing the government. A Revolutionary War veteran named Anthony Haswell, who was the editor of the Vermont Gazette newspaper, was imprisoned for placing ads in Vermont newspapers requesting donations to help pay Congressman Lyon's fines. So for simply putting an ad in a newspaper, this Revolutionary War veteran was put in prison. And the Reverend John C. Ogden carried a petition to Philadelphia for the release of Congressman Lyon and was in prison for doing that. Pardon me, Terry. I'm saying goodnight to my granddaughter.
I think we can excuse that.
Well, she came all the way outside to make sure she could say goodnight to her grandpa. So, goodnight, baby.
Drum kisses.
All right, I'm done.
I think you're just getting started.
Okay. Well, I thought it was, when we look at this, look at the people they're putting in prison. At least 21 newspaper editors, all of whom supported Thomas Jefferson, were put in prison. Is that not complete Marxism? Is that not something we would have expected out of Stalin or Hitler or somebody like that in history? And that is part of our history that we aren't taught about? Not one Federalist was harassed by the Sedition Act. And according to historian Claude Bowers, he said, everywhere men were being intimidated into silence. And he called it the Federalist Reign of Terror in America. Now, why aren't we taught this, Terry? Why is this not part of our history? Hamilton, although he did not lobby for
the Sedition Act. I said it earlier.
Go ahead.
If people understood this stuff, they wouldn't let them get away with it the way they have. That's the reason they've had to control the media and the movie production studios. They knew back in 1897. They knew that they had to take advantage of this new technology and control the narrative, both through news and movie production.
Well,
and that's exactly
what
they've done.
Right.
They've stayed in control of it all the way up until now. They knew it then, and they know it now.
Well, I think it was ironic, and most people couldn't answer this question, but I mentioned Congressman Lyon, L-Y-O-N, mentioned him being in prison for actually speaking out against the government as a member of government, and he spoke out against it, and he was imprisoned, ironically, in 1801, when the 1800 election went to the Congress to pick the president between Jefferson and Aaron Burr, Lyon cast the deciding vote for Thomas Jefferson.
Seems like we need to do a show sometime in the fairly near future. We need to do a program on just bring out key people from all the way back then. You just mentioned these 20 editors. Bring it forward. You know, we talk about people like Tupper Saucy and like that that congressman that they dieseled and the guy Bradley that they took out in the plane. He was actually a Democrat, maybe the last good Democrat known in the United States. But even idiots like Schaefer Cox, what's going on with General Flynn right now, or had been going on until the appeals judge finally put a stop to it, that Judge Sullivan, I mean, we've had Judge Sullivans all the way back then, obviously, or else those 20 people would have never gone to prison. So
well,
I think we need to probably focus a program on how many people, you know, political prisoners, if you want to call them that, have been put behind bars because of pseudo laws that were put in place just to silence people.
Well, I find it ironic.
Yeah, we got the
Terry, that the only person that you could criticize without going to prison under the Sedition Act, the only person you could criticize in government was Thomas Jefferson. There was no penalty for criticizing Thomas Jefferson.
How is that not a violation of the First Bill of Rights?
Well, Terry, you know, here was the thing, and you said, you told me that you had been reading my lessons that I send out. You had been reading, and I've really gotten into the Bill of Rights, and that has become such an intriguing journey for me to really see how all of this happened with the Bill of Rights. And see, here was the thing that I think the contract was broken in the very beginning, because especially in Federalist 45 and in several others, the Federalists kept telling the Anti-Federalists, George Mason, Elbridge Gerry, and others, they kept telling them, you do not need a Bill of Rights because the federal government does not have the right or the authority to infringe upon the rights of an individual. Now, this is what they promised. Of course, George Mason told them, there's a couple of things that worry me about this. You're telling me we don't need a Bill of Rights because the state's Bill of Rights will defend us all. You know, there's a couple of things in your Constitution that trouble me there, and number one is the Supremacy Clause, and number two is the Necessary and Proper Clause, which pretty well tell me that you can do anything you want to and the you will violate the individuals in the states. You will violate their liberties. So, but they were promised that the federal government would never violate the liberties of the people of the states. And so when they did it the first time, Terry, they broke the contract. And the contract became null and void because they broke the contract and offered no remedy. So the contract was broken, so the ratification was broken, and it was broken in the very beginning. Because they immediately started, and you know, what's the difference in the tea in Boston and the whiskey in Western Pennsylvania? Pardon me. What's the difference between them? Their mode of collection. What was the difference in King George sending over shiploads of redcoats to enforce his taxing laws? What was the difference in him and Madison and Hamilton and George Washington taking an army of 15,000 men into western Pennsylvania to collect a whiskey tax? What's the difference? Does tyranny taste better if it's
I don't ever remember being told in school that that happened.
Well, it did. And the thing of it was, and I was talking with a friend back in Arkansas. Hi, Anthony. I hope you're listening. I talked with him. We kind of were going back and forth, and someone had offered him evidence in some way, and of course it was probably from Wikipedia, that Washington and Hamilton were justified in going into western Pennsylvania to collect this whiskey tax because James Wilson, a Supreme Court justice, had told them it was okay. Well, you know what's conveniently left out of that whole thing is the fact that good old George Washington went to John Jay, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and asked him if it was constitutional for them to go into Pennsylvania to collect a tax, and the Chief Justice told him, no way. It absolutely was unconstitutional. So Washington goes to Hamilton. Now, this is all in letters. I can show you the letters on this. So Washington then writes to Hamilton and says, look, John Jay says this is unconstitutional. And so Hamilton says, well, I believe I can take care of that. And so Hamilton goes to his fellow banking buddy, who he helped make millions of dollars with his assumption rules, and he goes to him and he says, hey, he said, you're on the Supreme Court and you have been a senator. Is it constitutional for us to go into Pennsylvania and collect a tax? And he said, oh, yeah, of course, go right ahead. Well, the other thing they don't tell anybody is the fact that Hamilton's excise tax on whiskey only hit the common man because whiskey was the drink of the common man. Hamilton made sure he put no tax on wine. So, and the people in the western part of the country were producing whiskey as a form of income. So here was to get the common taxpayer. Here again was Hamilton trying to get the lowly man that he had no regard for, and to tax him for the benefit of the others. So, and even if a Supreme Court justice said, okay, you guys go ahead, it's constitutional, well, you know, so what? It's not, because Article 4, Section 4 completely forbid it. Article 4, Section 4 said no. So, you know, they did it anyway. So, again, and you're right, Terry, why weren't we taught about this? Why didn't they tell us in school that, hey, you know, Washington went in there to collect a tax, and that wasn't any different from King George doing it? Why do they not teach the truth? Anytime somebody seeks to keep the truth from you, there has to be a reason. Your thoughts?
I was just thinking of how badly I always hated the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah, uh-huh. And basically that has been played out so many times. One of the reasons, Terry, that, and most people don't know this, but one of the reasons that so many of our founders feared a standing army and didn't want a standing army at all, one of the biggest reasons for that was the fact that King George had used a standing army to collect taxes. And in the Virginia Ratification Convention, Patrick Henry referred to them as the federal sheriffs because, you know, he didn't know about the IRS back then. He wouldn't have known what to call them. And so he called them the federal sheriffs. And he said, in the Virginia Ratification Convention, he said, the federal sheriffs will come in and eat out your sustenance. And what, how can you stop them from doing so? There's nothing in the Constitution that allows you to stop the federal, he called them the federal and state sheriffs. How do you stop them from unlimited taxation? He said, they will come into your homes. Patrick Henry described the illegal incursions that are happening into people's homes by the police right now. He described that in 1788, in June of 1788. That is why, Terry, I've talked to you about this. I've said, you know, I don't understand if people want a really great movie into a movie, I think would be Unreal. Because there is so much intrigue, there's so much violence, there's so much stuff in here that people claim they want to see, but I can assure you no one is going to tell the American public the truth about the founding era of this country. It's just not going to happen. Of course, within a few months, they may be willing to tell you anything you want to because the people will be subjected to vaccinations and anything else that the federal government wants to do.
I just wonder how much flack that would raise to try to produce a movie that told the truth about this.
Well, you could talk to, I don't remember his first name right now, but you could talk to, I think it was Ron Maxwell, who was going to do a three-part series on the Civil War. And he did Gettysburg first. He did them out of sequence. He did Gettysburg first, and then he did the great movie, in my opinion, and it should be to everyone, called Gods and Generals. And after Gods and Generals exposed the fraud that most people are tearing monuments down today for, when that was exposed, immediately his program was shut down. And I thought it was ironical that the person who provided the money for this was Ted Turner. Of all people, he even had a cameo in Gods and Generals. And he had provided the money for this, but after Gods and Generals caught so much flack from the politically correct Marxist police, they just dropped the third one, and the third one would have been epic, I think. But they had to stop that on the spot. They could not allow the truth to start getting out here, filtering out to the people. They just couldn't do that.
We need to, I'll reach out to my my award-winning producer and patriot and see what he says about this. I'm sure he would also have some ideas on how to raise money.
Oh, that would be epic. I'm not sure, you know, you're going to have to find someone with the money like Ted Turner, and I believe that the government would put so much pressure on him. Terry, one of the things I remember back in the 1980s when I was with the American Foundation for Accountability and Prisoners of War and Missing in Action, and I remember how hard we were trying to get out the truth about the prisoners of war from Vietnam and how the government had the government was lying about these prisoners of war, lying about what happened to them, lying about so many things. We were trying to get out the evidence, and we actually had a concert planned for Tampa, Florida. And we had worked on the concert, and we had Charlie Daniels was going to be there. Johnny Cash was going to be there. Some other people had already said that they would be there for this concert, this benefit concert for the POWs. And lo and behold, the first thing we start hearing is, well, okay, number one, the city of Tampa has said you can't use their stadium. And then the next thing that happened was the individual record companies of the people who said they would be there had said, had called up Charlie Daniels and Johnny Cash at the time and said, no, you can't do that. We'll violate your contract if you do. So if you aren't familiar with how the influence of these people, when they see anything that would endanger their machine, they go into full block mode. And I would just be surprised if anybody was able to get out anything. Thoughts, my friend?
My wheels are turning.
Well, what do you want to do next week, Terry?
Well, do we continue this Swindled from the Beginning series, or do you want to shift gears?
Well, I would like to come back to it, but I think it would be a great time to maneuver into another subject. I think we're beating this one pretty good. Let's give the people a little bit of chance to rest their heads, and let's come back with another subject.
We had a pretty good show that 1 week we veered off and did the current event situation. I think it's time to refresh that.
Well, that sounds good.
We now understand just how harmful this shutdown is, both from a psychological, sociological, physical health. We pretty much got a handle at this point. I mean, I don't know if you saw that video or not of the guy that had the oxygen level tester that's OSHA approved and calibrated weekly and showed that the oxygen levels are supposed to be between 20% and 21% on the air that you're breathing, and that the OSHA has a 19.5% limit that they require employers to ensure. In other words, if your environment is below that, they have to provide breathing apparatus so that you can keep your oxygen level above 19.5. And the video that the guy's doing the test with the mask is showing that they're dropping from 20.5 down to 17.5% oxygen content and under that mask. You know, that sort of thing needs to be made very public.
Well, I agree with that, so Terry, and here's my question. Here's a question that I have. I would like to cover this, is how does a virus that we were told in February would not be able to exist in temperatures over 80 degrees, how is this virus becoming epidemic in the hottest states in the Union in the middle of June?
Well, just looking at the actual numbers on it, it's not an epidemic. It doesn't even meet the criteria of epidemic.
I'm talking about their allegations. Terry, are you familiar with what an algorithm is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, do you know that there are deceptive algorithms?
Say that again?
By design. There are deceptive algorithms by design, and I would like for our audience to try this for themselves. I want them to go to Google, type in any three-digit number you can come up with, and do several of them. Type in any three-digit number, and then type in new space cases, and then hit search button. Care what three-digit number you come up with, there is an algorithm that will show you that there are that many new cases somewhere in the United States. I don't care if you go 999 or 101. You're going to find out that there's an algorithm on Google to show you new cases regardless of the number you put into that search.
You your sound was inconsistent enough through that I couldn't make out a couple of the words.
Okay.
I heard
the
numbers.
Put any three-digit number you want. Put any three-digit number into a Google search engine and put any three-digit number and then put a space and then put the word new, N-E-W, space, and then put cases, C-A-S-E-S, and then hit search. And you, I don't care what number you put into that Google search engine, you will come up with a story about that many new cases somewhere. Whether it's 101 or 999 or anything in between, you're going to get a news story about that many new cases somewhere in America. And if you people believe that that is fact, then you absolutely, everybody should be wearing a mask over their eyes as they drive down the interstate.
Well, when you get involved in digital currency and blockchain, the blockchain is based on algorithm. And of course, being a math student, I understand that there's more than one meaning to the term algorithm as well.
Oh yes, well, the NSA, the No Such Agency, has been using them for as long as there's been computers to introduce false information into the public sphere. And we can go back to 1981 to the wonderful director of the CIA, Mr. Casey, when he said that we will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. That's 1981, folks, almost 40 years ago.
Yeah, if everybody wants to know about Bill Casey, they need to go watch that interview that Ted Gunderson did with Chip Tatum.
Yeah, that's a good source as well. Very much so.
Well, we've got about 10, 15 more minutes here, 10 to 12 minutes here. How do you want to close this out? Are we agreed?
Well,
are we agreed to go to current event? Something current event next week?
Absolutely, that's something I would love to do. But I also want to put a stipulation in, Terry, if I may, that at some point in time, I would really like to do an in-depth story on the prisoners of war missing in action debacle that the federal government was involved in, from all the way from World War One to the Middle East. And how they have let our enemies take our fighting men and put them into all kind of programs and everything else. Afterwards, what North Korea, China, Russia, what they have done with our military personnel is absolutely inexcusable.
How about 2 weeks? Not next week, but the week after.
I'm good.
Because I believe that's important.
That is something I think everyone should know about. And I was fortunate or unfortunate enough, however you want to make the story. I started out, pardon me, with the American Foundation for Accountability of Prisoner of War Missing in Action in Washington, D.C. in the mid-80s. I started out in public relations. I traveled around the country giving presentations on our POWs, primarily at that time the Vietnam POWs. And then I later became vice president of that organization. And we fought very hard in Congress. We fought very hard through a lot of various organizations to try to present to the American public the truth about the cover-up that the government was doing on the POWs from Vietnam, how they had covered up POWs from Korea, how they had covered up POWs all the way back to World War II and World War I, even to the point of allowing 21,000 and some American POWs to be taken by the Russians into Russia at the end of World War II. after they had been liberated from the German POW camps. And then there was a massive program set up to hide the fact that that had actually occurred. Though there are some great stories there, Terry. I would really like to get into that.
2 weeks from today.
You got it, buddy.
How do you want to close this lesson out? I know there's some stuff that you haven't totally brought out here yet.
Well,
the fact that they've made Hamilton and Madison to be such heroes is just it disgusts me more and more. The more we get into this, the more we see how much of the crooks that they were and how they schemed to basically facilitate their theft. It's just shocking to me that people have allowed these people to be deified, glorified the way that they have.
Well, that is your revisionist history. That is how we go about, the revisionist history thing. You have your revisionist historians like David Barton out there telling everybody that the Constitution was inspired by God, that all of these wonderful people in Philadelphia were Christians. But he doesn't bother to tell people that these wonderful Christians, as he calls them, actually had any oath to the Christian faith removed from anybody holding office, whether by in the state or federal level. They did not want anyone to take an oath to Christianity. Now, I ask you, if you get 59 Christians together in an enclave somewhere, how many of them will vote not to have prayer?
Well, I know some
whole part of
walk
it,
out.
It's preposterous.
If you don't.
It's preposterous. Yeah. It's preposterous that they have been able to get. Go ahead.
What's your take on LaRouche and the LaRouche Pack and their glorification of FDR? Speaking of monuments that has no mention of our Father in Heaven.
Well, if we want to talk about FDR, I don't know how you can get past the fact that he, with his associates, especially in the New York Times, helped cover up the massacre that Stalin was doing in the Ukraine in the 30s, 32 and 33, where Stalin, mass genocide of 7 to 9 million Ukrainians. And the fact that FDR knew this and knew this very well, and then just a few short years later brought in Uncle Joe, as he called him, Uncle Joe Stalin, brought him into the Allies. And there is a good case, Terry, if you want to talk about it, that could be made that the United States pushed Japan into creating an entry for the U.S. into that war simply because Hitler was kicking Joe's butt in Russia. We basically entered that war so we could become allies with Russia to preserve them from the onslaught by Hitler. There's quite a bit of evidence that can prove that. It was the British who were busy. They had said that, I've got quotes from Churchill in 32 and 33 talking about how they had to have a war with Germany. They couldn't allow Germany to do the things they wanted to do. And look, who was in the United States 1938? Who was Time Magazine's Man of the Year? Adolf Hitler. 1939, who was Time Magazine's Man of the Year? Joseph Stalin. This revisionist history has destroyed us, Terry.
Lack of knowledge of the real history has destroyed us.
Well, that is true, but people don't want to look. They love comfortable lies. They will do anything they can to get away from an uncomfortable truth. They'll call you racist, homophobe. They'll call you neoconservative. Anything that they can do
to shut you up when they don't have any facts to counter your position.
Well, from what I'm seeing, there's so many people out there that are willing to rat somebody out and somehow make themselves feel good about it, when all the people are trying to do that they're ratting out is to spread truth. You know,
can't have that.
Ron Paul's statement comes to mind so often to me. You know, his statement that truth is treason in the empire of lies. That comes to mind almost daily in what I'm witnessing out there. And I'm not talking about people that are showing up at the Capitol or protests. I'm talking about people in their homes that are just paranoid. I mean, they're, you know, these people, it's like you said earlier, we don't need an IQ test anymore. All you got to do is look for people that are wearing masks driving in their car. It's scary.
Well, yesterday I did an impromptu test. And you know, you and I can talk about that privately sometime, but I had to go out and I had to venture into the public sphere yesterday for a couple of hours. And I just made notes on my phone of the number of people I saw wearing masks. And I broke them down into categories. And when I got home and looked at all those categories, it became quite interesting.
You don't want to share any of that on here, huh?
Well, I think you and I need to go through the data first and then see what we think is relevant and what isn't.
Okay. All right. We can do that. Some total, have you totaled up how much Hamilton and Morris and those guys, how much total they stole?
And the dollars of the day back then or the dollars today?
Well, let's start with the dollars back then, and we can relate it to today. I mean, it looks to me to be something close to $100 million.
Well, here was the thing that was very unusual, Terry, is the fact that there was no doubt that Robert Morris profited according to, you know, and nobody has refuted it. The revisionist historians have said that it was unfounded, but they offer no evidence to that effect. But there was, according to Sentinel, Samuel Bryan, you know, that old thing, qui bono, what did he have to gain by proving that Robert Morris had stolen this amount of money? So we know that between what Robert Morris walked out of and during the Revolutionary War with all of his enterprises and what he got from the assumption laws, assumption acts, that one man, Robert Morris, probably ended up somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 million in dollars of that time. And the irony of all ironies is, after he completed his term as a U.S. senator, where he got involved in even more and more schemes and programs, at the end of his political career, he was in debtor's prison. And there's documentation that Washington went to visit him in debtor's prison. But more than also very revealing is a letter from Robert Morris to Hopkinson, who was also from Pennsylvania, during the time of the drafting of the Bill of Rights. In that letter, Robert Morris is criticizing James Madison, and he says that Madison is haunted by the words of Patrick Henry in the Ratification Convention. And he says, well, I'm not sure, and I'm paraphrasing his comment, but he says, I'm not exactly sure how this is going here, how this is going to go with these new amendments, but I can tell you this, sir, if they get the right amendment, I'll hang. So is that an admission of guilt?
You know, he's writing to a friend and says, if they come up with the right amendment to this Constitution, I will hang.
I see we've got somebody with a hand up. Do you want to risk it?
Oh, are they going to talk about our sexual preferences again?
I don't know. We'll find out, but I don't have time to screen it. I don't have any way or anybody producing in the background that can screen it. So all I'll say is this. I'm going to give you a live mic, but there's no bloviating. If you've got a question for Mike or I, please ask your question. Otherwise, we will shut that mic back off. So I'm going to give you a fair warning before I do it. Area code 407.
This is Nathan in Orlando. I don't know the definition of the word you said, bloviating. I don't have a question. I do have a comment that goes along with what you guys were talking about in revealing the true heart of our history. Here's my thing. The Constitution, when it was written, okay, it was like, this is the best way to say it. If you were to, we were to cook a cake and we took the ingredients and we debated, everybody had an idea of which ingredients to put in and which to take out. And when we got done with this cake would not taste like the original cake with the ingredients in it. We would have something, even if we like what we are eating, it is not what was intended. If we could get a group of people on a ship with just the Constitution, and they got shipwrecked on an island, and they took this document, just the Constitution, and they created a government, by the time we found that country, it would be nothing like what we would understand, one, because they weren't under the pressure of war trying to get this thing off the ground, and the other one would be what was in the Constitution originally is repeated time and time and time, and even made more clear in the Bill of Rights and the Declaration and the amendments. Everything that was promised to the people in the Constitution, and I understand that these people were under the pressure of, they sacrificed everything, they gave some of them their lives, their money, and their families were shattered. Okay, they had the wars of the horrors of wars in their mind. And so they tried to hang on. I can understand human nature wanting to hang on to what they accomplished, but in the process, they violated the rights. Everything that was made clear in the Bill of Rights was what was promised. I remember this lady, Elizabeth Powell, went up, I believe it was to Madison, and said, "Sir, what kind of government did you give us?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it," meaning, you know, it's for a moral people. Well, that lady never got the vote. That was Franklin. Okay, but that lady never got the vote. Her daughter, her granddaughters for generations. And if you look at the 13th Amendment, first time on paper the black man got to vote after he was freed. Okay, the 14th gave the white man the first time able to vote on paper in the 14th, but neither one of them could vote because they used to have a rule, and I understood this, and I understand it, and they should have amended the Constitution and be fair. If you don't own property, you can't vote. That would cause people to inspire them to work and one day own something and be able to participate, but they didn't, and it's the same with...
Hold on. We've only got about 1 minute left, and
okay.
I want Mike to be able to comment to what you've already said to close us out. And that was a good comment. Thank you.
I appreciate the comment. The only problem that I have is these people in 1787 were under no threat of war. And most of them, some of them had participated in the war. Washington had for sure. But Robert Morris and these other financiers and these wealthy people hadn't participated in the war. And they had no threat of war. And what they put together was a scheme. And it was a criminal conspiracy, according to Samuel Bryan. And I think the evidence is there. And, you know, you can look at the Bill of Rights all you want to. If you can't recite everything that happened in the first Congress about what happened with this, it's a fruitless argument.
I wish you would have got me on earlier. But anyway, thank you.
I'm sorry, I just saw your hand up. I was not on your, I wasn't on the switchboard, so sorry. Mike, I'm sorry I hit yours by mistake. We're out of time. We'll see you next week with some current events issues, and then in 2 weeks we'll be back to talk about what Mike described earlier. Everyone, thank you for listening tonight. We appreciate our listeners very much. We'll see you next week, 6 o'clock Thursday night, same nest, same time. Bye, Mike.
Good night.
To your government walls, all of you, you dadgum government, you sorry rattle cratchit, you got yourself an itch and you're wanting me to scratch it. Well, you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government, Oh, don't you know? Shoe-fitting fire starters ought to tell you no good preambulatory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos, you got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes.